UK Wine Show, show number 145. John Forrest on the Waitaki Valley. G'day. Welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 145 for the 27th of February 2009. My name's Chris Scott, and on this week's show, we're talking with John Forrest from the Waitaki Valley in New Zealand. In the spotlight, we're looking at wine and food matching. This time, we're looking at the classic combination of wine and cheese. And in the quote this week, "The great evil of wine is it first seizes the feet. It's a crafty wrestler." Who said that? Clues throughout the show? Answer at the end. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. The biggest promotional campaign for fair trade products began on 23rd of February and will run until the 8th of March. Fair Trade Fortnight is being supported by retailers across the UK with a range of in-store offers on fair trade wine, including award-winning Chilean producer Equality by Las Lomas. UK sales of products carrying the Fairtrade mark reached an estimated value of £700 million in 2008, an increase of 43% over 2007. And sales of Fairtrade wine grew by 27% in 2008. And there are now 280 Fairtrade wines available in the UK.
This year's Fairtrade snuck up on us, and looking around, it appears to have less going on this year than possibly in the past. Something that is getting loads of coverage at the moment is wine on TV. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, Chris, in the final episode of BBC4 series Wine, the International Wine Challenge will be featured, with a behind-the-scenes insight into the judging process of the world's leading wine competition. Viewers will see IWC co-chairman Tim Atkin, MW, Charles Metcalf and Derek Smedley, MW, judge the wines produced by two South African winemakers at the end of their quest to produce wines worthy of an IWC award. The programme will be aired on Monday the 2nd of March.
Sheesh! I thought our lead times were long. The TV show was recorded the same day I judged at the IWC last year, about 9 months ago. This week on TV we also had the last episode of Oz and James Drink to Britain, with the tasting at Breaky Bottom and another talk with Dermot Sugu, the ex-winemaker at Nye Timber. You can still download that from iPlayer if you missed it. But with the end of the TV series, we have the beginning of the new Harper's Wine and Spirit magazine.
The first issue of the new Harper's Wine and Spirit Trades Review was unveiled this week, a merger of Harper's and the Wine and Spirit magazine. The title will be published fortnightly, a big move after more than a century of Harper's as a weekly publication. The new magazine promises to have broad appeal across the whole drinks trade, where Harper's has traditionally been more focused on the wine industry. The owner, William Reed Business Media, also owns two major drinks industry events, the International Wine Challenge and the Restaurant Show, which no doubt will benefit from being promoted through the newly created title. That's it from me this week, but don't forget you can get these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Thanks, Jane. This week in the spotlight, we're going to be looking at wine and cheese matching. But before we look at some of the combinations, what is cheese? Well, cheese is normally made from either cow, goat, or sheep milk, and from a structural point of view, it can be high or low in salt, umami, fat, and acidity. And each one of these can react with wine. Now, the general wisdom with cheese and wine matching is that white wines match best with soft cheese and strong flavours. Red wines match best with hard cheese and milder flavours. Fruity and sweet wines, but not dry, and dessert wines work best with a wider range of cheese. And finally, the more pungent the cheese you choose, the sweeter the wine should be. Now, determining why these guidelines should work is really quite hard. But from referring back to the basic guidelines on food and wine matching we talked about last week, we can get a couple of ideas about matches. First of all, red wine and cheese, which is often quoted as a perfect combination, isn't necessarily so. Often it's white wines that work best with cheese. But if you're looking for a match to match with red wines, you want to think about high-fat cheese. Cheeses, especially high in fat, tend to coat the mouth, masking the taste of tannins. The other thing to avoid is cheeses high in salt. Salt tends to highlight tannins. And as many cheeses have significant salt, because it's required to both flavour the cheese but also to control microbial processes, red wine and cheese are not necessarily the best combination. But if you must choose a cheese high in fat, think cheddar, Cheshire, Double Gloucester, Parmesan, Roquefort, Stilton, and Wensleydale. With some cheeses being pungent, matching them with sweet wines makes sense. The following guideline from last week, match the weight of the food with the wine, means that sweet wines have quite a lot of weight, so they can hold up quite well to stronger flavoured cheese. It's also true that cheese is usually fairly dry, so the guideline, the dessert wine should be sweeter than the dessert, also holds true. But how about something like Parmesan and Champagne as a combination? Well, Parmesan is incredibly high in umami at 1.68 grams of glutamic acid, which is umami, for each 100 grams. It's around 1.6-1.7% pure umami. To put that in perspective, Marmite is 1.9% umami, which is just a wee bit more, but Marmite is Mr. Umami. While cheddar cheese is only 0.07% umami, which shows that umami can range from quite high, Parmesan, to very low with cheddar cheese. Knowing that foods high in umami are also enhanced by foods high in umami, you can expect that a wine high in umami, such as vintage champagne, would work well with Parmesan cheese, which it does. Now, the other combination that could possibly work is Manzanilla sherry, which is also high in umami and hints of salt, and that should work very well with Parmesan as well. But I've yet to try that. So I'll report back on that one next week. Next week, we're actually going to be looking at our poll. And the poll this week is, the UK government advises drinking no more than 3 to 4 units of alcohol a day for men, 2 to 3 for women. A unit's 8 grams of alcohol. Would you say you regularly drink more, less, about that, don't know, or don't care? If you want to have your say, go to our website, 3050.co.uk. Click on podcast at the top and have your say. It's on the right-hand side of the screen. We asked this question about 18 months ago, so it's going to be quite interesting to see if there's been any change in attitudes. Some things that don't change is the quote this week. It's from 190 BC, which puts it over a couple of thousand years old, but it still holds true today. The great evil of wine is that first it seizes you by the feet. It's a crafty wrestler. Now, I like this quote, but it is a pretty hard person to guess, unless you know a lot about early Roman musical theatre. Anybody out there with that? His comedies, though, are the earliest works of Latin literature surviving today, and they sparked on his epitaph. Since he is dead, comedy mourns. Deserted is the stage, then laughter, jest, and wit, and melody's countless numbers all together wept. Sounds like an excellent and fun man all around. I'll give you his name after the interview with Dr. John Forrest. Now, we've had Dr. John Forrest on before. He's the winemaker and owner of Forrest Estates in New Zealand. Not only is he a huge Riesling fan, but John was one of the first people to invest in the Waitaki Valley. We talked to him about why. Hi, I'm here with John Forrest from Forrest Estates. John is one of the few people who've started planting up in the Waitaki Valley in North Otago. I just thought we'd have a chat about North Otago wines and what really led you to go down to Waitaki Valley, John.
Well, I was arm-twisted by an unfortunately now deceased Howard Patterson, who was a famous entrepreneur in the southern part of New Zealand who saw the potential of the valley for viticulture. And after sort of 2 years of badgering me, he put me in a helicopter and flew me up there. And one look from the air at the region convinced me that it could grow grapes and it could be exciting. And then one look at the geology of the region absolutely convinced me that it could be the Chablis of the south, because it has, relatively unique in New Zealand, we have very little high limestone soils, and this particular region has exactly that, high limestone soils generated as the sea has risen and fallen over the last, 2 or 3 million years. And what you see, and I've got some lovely shots of it, are 2 foot sort of layers of white calciferous soil with billions of shells, which you can still pick out the shells actually out of these layers, and then a layer of riverbed where the rivers come back and the seas, levels dropped and it's been land again for God knows how many thousands of years, and then the sea's risen again and another white layer been deposited and it's gone on and on and on. So it's just one of those unique sites in the world where calcium is a dominating influence on the terroir of the region.
Like some people
are terroirists, or I like to call them terrorists. but, you know, they believe that the flavour of the wine comes from the soils. Some people are more, there's porosity and permeability. You know, some soils let water through, some soils retain water, so there's a site selection based on that basis. You're a flavour man from the soils?
Yeah, I must admit, I'm a terroir man, and I certainly, as I get more experience in winemaking and maybe get older, I'm trying to express that terroir more and more in the context of how I make the wines, and less input from me, I suppose.
Okay, so what sort of grapes do you think you grow? Oh, you've planted up in Waitaki?
Planted up in Waitaki, and as sort of there's half a dozen other wine companies. Unique, actually, for the New Zealand wine scene, in that it's a region that's just taking off, not by, if you like, nutters who've gone there as experimenters and grown a few grapes and it's worked, like Martinborough, example of that. It's actually a region that's been chosen, and if you like, the who's who of New Zealand winemakers, there's the high quality individual guys, and obviously which I consider myself one, have gone there and gone out on the limb to do it. So it started off with a hiss and a roar, even though it's still a very small region. It's had a lot of profile because the people there have credibility.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who else is there?
Craigie Range, Grant Taylor, who's the winemaker from Gibston Valley. Mm-hmm. Osler, there's a label that's there. Jeff Sinnott, who's a fantastic winemaker, ex-Marlborough winemaker now in Central Otago. So there's some really good people there.
Okay, and it's the limestone that you're looking for.
Limestone. So what are we planting? Well, we're planting Pinot Noir because, you know, the Pinots from the region are definitely, you know, they come from Central Otago, but they're distinctly different. We'll talk about that in a moment, perhaps. But so it's Pinots, obviously. Pinot Gris. There's only been two Pinot Gris from the region, but that's what actually convinced me to buy and put a lot of money into there. I thought it was the most fantastic Pinot Gris I've ever tried in my life. And I think I've made a Chardonnay this year, and it's so different to any other Chardonnay I've ever seen or drank or made in New Zealand, and it's so Chablis-like as to be incredible. So I think whatever goes well on limestone in a global context will do well there. So watch the space, really.
You mentioned that you think the style is slightly different from maybe Central Otago in this North Otago Waitaki area.
Yeah.
What, first of all, can you define what Central Otago Pinot is?
To me, Central Otago Pinot is two things. It's black cherries, if you're looking for a flavour descriptive, a one only. I mean, it's not all that, but that's what the classic Central Otago is, that bright black cherries. And the other thing about Central Otago is that it has a bright, fresh acidity in the context of Pinot Noir I'm talking about.
Mm.
And that always in those, if you play those paper bag games and guessing games with wine, that's how I always pick Central Otago Pinots, on those two parameters.
Okay, and how does Waitaki differ from that?
Waitaki has a black cherry fruit dimension, but it has two other things. It has more spice or herbal aromas. I'm talking about ripe herbs here, from rosemary and thyme. And then the wine, when it's open in the glass or the decanter, it always ends up with a earthy minerality that's I've never seen in Central Otago. And that I think, is the limestone. I see that same character in that Gris I described, same character in abundance in that Chardonnay. So every varietal that's come from the Waitaki appears to have what I describe as an earthy minerality, it's great. I think one of the hallmarks of successful wine regions is a unique signature.
Yep.
And I think this region has a unique signature, just like Marlborough Sauvignon. You know.
The Waitaki Valley is quite a long valley. It goes all the way from Marama all the way down to the sea. Where are you planting up?
So it's critical, actually, and that's what the helicopter trip showed me. It's 40k inland, and that's significant because the North Otago Plains, which are from the coast to that 40k point, are too cold in the summer because of the cold Antarctic easterly breezes. Whereas you get to a little place called Duntroon, where the mountains from the north and the south basically cross each other, and the only opening is the Waitaki River pushing through that these low mountains, and it just stops the cold afternoon breeze. You go 20k up the valley to Kurau, going west, and you're climbing an elevation, and that's about the extreme limit of grape growing because it becomes too cold. So there's a relatively small band of land on the south side. Remember, our sun is in the north, so it's terraces sloping to the north, so there's a few extra heat units, which is critical in the marginal area, and those terraces are lucky enough to be calciferous deposits.
Yeah. Is it before Benmore or after Benmore?
It's before Lake Benmore. Yeah, it's right. It stretches to Kurau, which is where the first dam called the original Waitaki Dam was put in, 80 odd years ago.
Inland, it's the end.
Yeah,
of it.
Well, actually, now right on the lake of Benmore, our biggest natural earth dam in the world, there are probably only 30 hectares of spotted vineyards right on the lake edge where they may be able to grow grapes even further inland, but they're special sites, with steep elevation to the north. And because of the warming effect of this massive blanket of water, Lake Benmore covers about, God knows how many, 100,000 hectares. It artificially warm and may keep the frost off them.
Okay, and you get reflection as well from the water. What about cropping levels? How many crop years have you been producing grapes there?
I've had five vintages now. It's a marginal area, that's got to be said, but there's a lot of New Zealand falls into that marginal area. And another truism of the world of wine is that often the greatest expression of a variety comes from the most marginal area at which it can grow. Mm-hmm. And that is the Waitaki Valley. We, last year, because of a cold December flowering, we had zero crop. So you are going to lose vintages. And this, here's a strange conundrum. Vintage variation is absolutely acceptable. In fact, it's become almost a positive in the old world of wine, because they grow in marginal areas, and you as a consumer in the traditional world accept that. But what we've done falsely in the new world is, and Marlborough Sauvignon is the leader of this, or Aussie Shiraz is close behind it, we've year after year delivered the goods for you, and you've come to expect that the new world will always produce good average wine. And what I'm saying is that we're now discovering areas that are much more inconsistent, just like the old world, but they could be great, or they could produce the greatest wines in the new world, and perhaps even the world, but don't expect it every year.
Yeah.
And that's the Waitaki Valley, and that's parts of Central Otago. I can name a half dozen areas in New Zealand, that would apply to.
Okay. So do you think that things like Bordeaux, the prices vary quite considerably from year to year? Sometimes even in a bad year, they still go up. But do you think that you will see price volatility in your region? Because that's one of the things about New Zealand wines is they don't seem to vary in price. And exchange rates probably have a bigger influence on pricing than say, the quality of the year.
Mm. I'd like to see that. And I think that's an honest reflection of that vintage variation, that price should change. We often handle it ourselves by having price or ranges of wine. So, in the average or less years, you won't see my better wines, and they are in a lower priced bracket.
What do you think the future is for Waitaki? Do you think there's going to be a lot more people going in there, or is it such a small area that it's almost all planted out now? Where are you at with development of the region?
The region's probably only 20 to 25% planted, so there's potential for growth, but that growth probably only stretches to 2,000 hectares maximum. So it's always going to be remembering that Marlborough is 20,000 hectares in the context. So it's always going to be a small region when and if it's fully developed. I think there's not a stampede of people in there. There's a steady interest, and I think it will grow. And one of the reasons, the major reason for that, is not that people don't think the region can do good wines, is that a lot of the industry, wine industry in New Zealand, is marginal at best financially, and I don't think there's that many companies with the financial resources to take the risk.
Okay. What about, so what's the land prices been doing then?
They've moved from about 10,000 to 20,000, 30,000, 5,000 a hectare. So there's been a significant appreciation in land prices. Well, reflecting, I think, the success of the three or four vintages we've had and the potential of the region. But until I think it's economically better proven, they'll probably sit at about that price. Just coming back to the climate, climatically, the subtle difference to Otago or central Otago is that because it's in between a continental climate and a coastal climate, it tends to have a longer ripening period, but no greater number of heat units than the cooler part, which is probably the Gibson Valley of central Otago. So on the face value of it, when you look at the climatic data, you think it's marginal or below marginal for grapes, but when you put it across the context of a longer ripening period, it seems to ripen grapes successfully.
Do you think the grape varieties that you'd be going for are things like Riesling and Pinot and Chardonnay? You think those are the three there? Or do you think there's going to be something new out of the blue that will surprise you all? You know, maybe a really cool climate grape variety, Bacchus, or something really strange coming in there?
I think just because of this limestone, I think, you know, individual expression of that limestone in classic varieties like Chardonnay or Pinot Gris and Pinot Noir will be the first phase of the Waitaki development, maybe the only phase.
What about sparkling wine? If you're a cool climate, you're on limestone, that's champagne country.
Yeah, should be fantastic, and maybe a good use. And it's one of the reasons I'm planting Chardonnay there, is that it could be used for that very purpose. And it may be that it alternates, it sounds strange to say it, but there's no reason that I can see physiologically that a region couldn't produce a stunning Chardonnay one year and, due to the climatic conditions, the next year produce a stunning bubbly base.
Okay. If so, it's a bit colder, you might produce a bubbly base. Yeah. What about different clones? They normally use different clones for fizz versus still.
Yeah, it's less of important, to be honest. Clonal, certainly over the expression of limestone.
All right, then, John, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thanks very much for your time.
Oh, pleasure.
I found it interesting that he thinks that the soil gives the wine an earthy minerality. I'll hopefully be in New Zealand in a couple of months' time, and I should be able to get hold of some Waitaki Valley wine at that stage, and we'll see what it's like for myself. I haven't been up the Waitaki Valley since the vines were planted, so I'm quite looking forward to that. But before we finish up, we have the quote. "The great evil of wine is that it first seizes the feet. It's a crafty wrestler." Well, the former Roman writer was Titius Marcus Platius from 190 BC. If you got it, I'm very impressed. And if you didn't get it, well, I wouldn't get too worried about it. It's still a great quote. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.